down on the internet. Welcome to episode 86 of the Extra Sequential podcast, hosted by myself, Mladen, and my friend Chris. How are you going, Chris?
Good. I'm your friend. I've been upgraded. I am coming at you from Perth, and we are talking about Image Comics. The wonderful works they've done in the past few years. They started with a lot of kind of cheesy superheroes with pouches and testosterone-fueled muscles.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about Image before on the show, and all the fun creator squabbles and the problems in the early 90s when people left and came on board and all that kerfuffle. But I thought it'd be nice that this week we're kind of looking, we're each picking our five favourite Image titles, personal favourites. Yes. This isn't an exhaustive list of which is the best ever Image. It's just our personal picks, and hopefully there'll be some titles here that you or I can surprise each other with, going, you know, I'd forgotten that time when Spawn met Cerebus, or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, correct. It'll be an interesting show. Yeah. So I think probably we've picked books that are more recent. So there's probably not a lot of 90s stuff, mainly stuff from the last millennium.
Yeah, I think I've only got one 90s choice on mine, and it's probably a surprise choice for a few people. I know it's not popular. So, this will be, I guess it's just different generational thing. And Image have changed so much, even over the course of the last 10 years.
Sure.
And over the 20 years, man, compare comics from their early days to now, it's really different. It's nice to see a publisher change so much as well. It's good. So,
a lot can change in 20 years. Just think about the fashions and the parachute pants and the neon colours on everything.
I'm pretty sure Rob Liefeld still wears a baseball cap backwards.
Yeah, you could be right.
Nothing's changed there. Let's get into the comic book news, Chris.
Okay.
There's a few news items this week, Christopher. I wouldn't mind opening with the Eisner Award nominees and just quickly mentioning that these have been announced.
Did you say Eisner? It should be Eisner. Eisner, like Ice Cube or Ice Tea.
It's a cold day in hell. and there's a, I guess, the Eisners aren't always a huge surprise sometimes. There's books there you expect to see, but there's a few which are kind of pleasing, as in Lock and Key, I think, got a nomination, as did The Unwritten. Daredevil, I think, got quite a few nominations this year.
Yep.
Noki Urasawa's 20th Century Boys. Usagi Yojimbo always gets a nomination. Have you noticed that every single year?
I haven't.
It's very common. who is Jake Ellis, which I know you're a huge fan
yes.
of, from Image Comics. Yeah, there you go.
And, okay, that's enough for that.
Anders Nielsen's Big Questions, which I was a fan of, also got a nomination, as well as a few others that we've reviewed on the show here and there. Check it out on
Atomic Robo.
Oh, of course.
Red 5. Jim Henson's A Tale of Sand, which we talked about in our Jim Henson special a couple of weeks ago. And one that I'm not familiar with, but I know you are because you're a wine, I'll say enthusiast, just to cover your any potential embarrassment, Drops of God, which was all about gorging oneself on the feast of grapes and the liquid contained within.
Yes, that's a fun one. Great manga title. And, check out the full list of nominees at the Comic Con website, comic-con.org, and then the Eisner Awards there, I think, the top link.
We'll put a link.
Yeah, we will. I don't think this isn't open voting for anyone, is it? There's another one.
No, that's what I was kind of hoping, but no, it's not open to esteemed journalists, and I use the term loosely, such as I and you, but it's open to, I believe, just industry professionals.
So I personally prefer that method to the Logie Award method, which is anyone who has a TV can vote for Neighbours this year.
That's the Australian TV Awards, which you mentioned, for our non-Australian listeners, of which we have quite a few. And I know you're a big fan of the Logies, and you always pick up your Women's Weekly, or whatever it is.
Yeah, my TV Week magazine and my Women's Weekly, so I can put in my vote for Rebecca Gibney in Underbelly Razor.
Yes.
I assume she's in that. But
sure, why not?
Yeah.
Gingell.
How do you feel about the do you prefer the open nomination thing, like an MTV award, or do you prefer being that it's industry selected?
I think it's good to have both. Like, I guess the Eisners are kind of compared to the Oscars, because Gwyneth Paltrow and Marissa Tomei win Eisner. No, that's not true, but because it's voted by the industry, I guess it's more prestigious. Like if something wins an Eisner, it'll get stamped on that trade paperback forevermore. Mm. Eisner winning, but if it's like a fan, what are the fan? I can't even. Harvey, are they? I don't know.
I think sure Harvey might be industry as well. I'm sure IGN does like reader picked polls.
Yeah, Wizard always used to do it.
Yeah. But I guess you get different cross-sections. Sometimes it's nice to, you know, be told that a comic that you haven't read is better than whatever you did read, just because it exposes you to books you haven't read. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, that is true. The diversity of this wonderful medium, which we love.
Yeah, you could find out about King's Speech, the Blue Water comic. What other news do we have, Chris?
April Fool's Day was, on April 1, because that's when fools are at their most prevalent and influential. Mm-hmm. There was a couple, not a huge, usually the comic websites will always put up some kind of phony news. I didn't notice a lot this year, but I did notice two at least, which was IDW had a press release talking about the Mars Attacks musical, which is going to be released on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I think it's written by John Layman, I think, who writes Chew, which I'll be talking about later. And the other one was Stephanie Brown, the former Robin and Batgirl, and now for DC Comics. Bleeding Cool kind of said that DC Comics were doing a Kickstarter campaign to do a Stephanie Brown series, which would actually work if it was legit. That would have got quite a lot of support. But alas, it is not to be.
It's like a kick in the teeth, isn't it?
Yeah, so she'll have forever remain etched on fans' hearts rather than on actual paper. So there was a couple of April Fool's Day pranks that I noticed, and some sites kind of ran with them legit, but not many.
I have two fun ones. If you're a fan of George Takei and you follow his various Twitterings he announced that he'd be the lead captain in a Star Trek spin-off film called Excelsior. Where,
that would have been awesome.
And no one believed it, but because it's like, no, of course not. But it was such a wonderful idea, and fans were flocking to say, you know, I would see that film, and I would too. So that's an exciting one. And a few days before April Fool's, so close that I had to check the date just to make sure I wasn't being April Fooled, the announcement that Triplets is in development. Now,
I actually almost fell for that one as well, yes.
It's real, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, it was announced 2 days before April 1st. So unless they're playing a long-term strategy, but a sequel to Twins.
Yes, with Eddie Murphy,
Eddie Murphy. As See, unless if they fudge with the dates to mess with me. But,
it's making us laugh, and we haven't even...
I hope
the last time Eddie Murphy made me laugh was in Norbit. No, not really.
That's another one I hope is true. Please be true.
One that is true is DC Comics are doing a He-Man and Masters of the Universe 6-issue series by James Robertson and Philip Tan, just announced. That's exciting. You're too young to remember He-Man.
Mm.
But trust me, it's exciting.
I'll take your word for it.
He hasn't had a comic for a long time.
Moving on.
Okay, I've got nothing else.
Good for you. All right. The news item this week, and how could we not announce it, Chris is an award-winning award-nominated panelist at...
Well, so are you.
Oh, so
we both nominated for a Tin Duck Award for Best Fan Production. So we may very well win, but there's been a couple of other podcasts and various fan productions that have popped up in recent times. But I was a panelist at SwanCon, the 37th annual SwanCon. Mm-hmm. Or DoomCon, as it's known this year, because of its apocalyptic theme. It's mainly a literary convention, but they've been having a greater comics focus in the last couple of years. So, I was quite honoured and blessed to be a panellist with a couple of other people.
Yeah.
One of the panels yesterday was on the DC relaunch, and the general consensus was that people hated it. And I also spoke last night on where people should begin with reading comics. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm doing another podcast without my long-time collaborate on Maladdin on tomorrow night with a couple of other people.
What?
Nevertheless, I will try and think like you, get inside your mind like a cop would.
What is this podcast? What are you doing? What are you doing without me?
It's a live podcast with two other people. I've told, don't try and feign insult to get listeners on your side, man, and paint me to be the bad guy.
What is this? Tell people where they can hear it and what it is.
I would if I knew any more details, but apparently it is going to be recorded, and I assume it will be put up on the SwanCon website, but you can not, you know, being an unashamed self-promoter, much like...
Well, I can't wait to hear this anyway, so I know how...
Because
you told me... In the right direction. You told me there was a PowerPoint that you'd prepared and charts and graphs.
I did. I had... PowerPoint, well, slideshow, both of the panels that I was in, and I brought a whole bunch of freebies and handed stuff out and talked to people about comics. So it was good. I enjoyed, you know, rocking the microphone and, you know, it was good.
Rocking the mic like a disaster.
Is that Vanilla Ice?
I have no idea.
I thought you knew the whole of Vanilla Ice's, you and your schoolyard chums would sing in the playground. For
well, this was private. And now it's public. Now it's been announced. My public image will never be the same again.
No, it's improved. You're welcome.
Speaking of image, let's talk about...
good segue.
Yeah, I thought so.
86 episodes and you're finally getting...
I'm getting better at this. On to Image Comics.
Image. The image in your mind. Image Comics, as we discussed many minutes ago, it is their 20th anniversary. So we are talking about our favourite Image titles. And as you said, young Lucaton, it is by no means an exhaustive list. We could do an entire podcast on Image Comics. Oh, there probably is one, I'd imagine. But we're just going to pick our favourite ones that we would recommend. And these will be easily accessible, kind of newbie-friendly, which is what our focus is on this show, and trades that you can get from your local comics retailer or library or friend or whoever happens to read comics, perhaps the loved one in your life.
Mm.
I did want to point out that Broken Frontier, which is a website I write for, is actually running Image Comics Month, all of this very month, which is April. So go on there for reviews of some older issues. David Hine just did a great little piece on, you know, working for Image as opposed to Marvel and DC. There's some great kind of articles and features, a couple of reviews in there by myself as well. So we'll, again, put a link up on our website for the wonderful work that Broken Frontier do. And you wanted to mention a documentary that is hopefully forthcoming.
Yeah, C-Cart, a great website for, I guess, literary discussion on comics. So they claim. I'm kidding. But they're producing a documentary film about Image called Comics in Focus, The Image Revolution. And it's going to be by the same team who should be familiar to a lot of people for the award-winning Grant Morrison Talking with Gods documentary. And Warren Ellison's... Warren Ellison. I'm thinking of Harlan Ellison, sorry.
Oh, yes.
Warren Ellis Captured Ghosts, as well as the upcoming Comics in Focus, Chris Claremont's X-Men doco, which is coming out soon. I'm looking forward to that one. But there's been a short trailer released along with a Kickstarter, and they want to reach a very modest $11,000 goal, basically to put to, arrange all the interviews with the other half of the Image creators, who I believe they've already got interviews with Mark Silvestri and a few other guys. So should be exciting stuff. And I've always enjoyed hearing about the early days of Image because, you know, you see a film like Social Network, Image has just as many, like, grandiose personalities, conflict, butting heads, people, friends becoming enemies and so forth. So that's going to be a fascinating doco when it comes out. So, yeah.
It's a very interesting time period, and you and I are quite fascinated by comics history. And yeah, I think the world cries out for a really cool documentary about this particular time as well, just Image kind of just meteoric rise. I guess.
And then a fictionalized film with Matthew McConaughey playing Rob Liefeld. Yes. Who else?
I took my shirt off in this scene. I did want to mention the Cartoon Arch Museum in San Francisco is actually running a Image exhibition featuring some original art from the last 20 years. That runs for, well, until the end of April 29th, so pretty much for the whole month. So if you are in San Francisco, check that out as well.
Great.
Whew. Let's talk briefly about what Image Comics is, man, what they represent. So I guess most people, if you've been reading comics for quite a while, you'd kind of be familiar with this story. It started with eight creators who were working for Marvel on some of their top tier works. They had Jim Lee doing X-Men, Rob Liefeld on X-Force, Mark Silvestri, you mentioned, a Wolverine, Eric Larson on The Amazing Spider-Man, Todd McFarlane was also doing another Spider-Man, Jim Valentino on Guardians of the Galaxy, and Will Sportacio on another X-Men. They kind of saw their characters that they were creating basically on all this merchandising and stuff and really not getting paid for it. It's a struggle that I guess continues, well, today, well, not, maybe not so much today, but more with the heirs of people that did a lot of work for Marvel DC back in the day. And so they basically got fed up and they approached Marvel and said, we want to get paid more for all the work than that you're exploiting us, man. And Marvel said, no way. Apparently Chris Claremont, who was writing Uncanny X-Men at the time, also teamed up with him, but I don't know. I mean, maybe he decided to stay with Marvel or whatever, but he was kind of supportive, I guess, but that, perhaps his support didn't go all the way to, oh, jump ship with you guys. So he stayed with Marvel. And so, yeah, basically these are creators founded Image Comics, much to the surprise of the, well, the whole industry, I guess, at the time. It was quite a, I mean, you and I weren't really reading comics at that time. I came into it a couple of years later, seriously, but
I guess it's a big deal because publishers pop up here and there all the time. What makes Image, what made Image special, one was that, yes, they were doing their creator-owned projects, but they were definitely a very commercial. They wanted to just form a new commercial mainstream comic publisher. They were they weren't aiming for highbrow art or anything like that. They just wanted to make sure that the writers and artists were getting a fair go and, you know, getting published in the way that they wanted without editorial influence, getting paid for it, which is nice, and getting to own whatever they published, which was very rare in mainstream comics, even to today. I'm not sure what the scenario is with Vertigo, but I'm sure you sign away a lot of rights, even on, you know, what we like to consider, you know, new independent titles on something like Vertigo. Image is still kind of the place to be as an independent artist, just to in terms of exposure and, yeah, getting your dues. So
it is. And like I say, when they first started, I mean, their stuff wasn't indistinguishable from a lot of the superhero stuff. I mean, even the characters looked kind of the same. Like you could say, oh, that guy looks just like Wolverine, but in a different colored costume and whatnot. So the first few issues started coming out in 1992. So Rob Liefeld's Youngblood, Eric Larson's The Savage Dragon, Tom McFarlane's Spawn, Jim Lee's Wildcats, and because these guys were artists and they knew that their art was selling the Spider-Man and X-Men books, their fans jumped ship with them. So unsurprisingly, their first issues were, well, unsurprisingly, popular and sold out and did really, really well. And the 90s was the boom time. The 90s was just the crazy. I mean, Tom McFarlane, he became a millionaire, mainly because of his toys and stuff, I guess. But these guys were, you know, there was like there was a Wildcats cartoon, wasn't there? I think there was a short-lived Savage Dragon cartoon. There was a quite mature adult Spawn cartoon. There was toys and all manner of things, video games, I'm sure. I think there was video games. But, yeah, the first few issues were actually initially published and kind of distributed and marketed through Malibu, a publisher, which Marvel brought out and then kind of didn't really do anything with for the first few months, and then Image Comics went independent and handled it all themselves later on. But see, if you compare those early stuff with the titles the Image are producing today, they're kind of, it's like a different publisher, isn't it? I mean, you've got, I mean, Spawn and Savage Dragon that are still around, but you've got The Walking Dead, which is hugely popular, the TV series. You've got last 2 years have just been sellout after sellout. So you've got like Skull Kickers, Morning Glories, Non-Player, Saga, Strange Talent, Luther Strode, revivals of Glory and Prophet and Young Blood on its way. It just seems like an entirely different publisher 20 years ago than it was today, than it is today.
Yeah, and the content from now until then, it's just, I guess the work they're putting out, maybe the commercial environment's changed as well. The books that are popular now aren't the same as the books that were popular in the 90s. You know, Scott Pilgrim probably wouldn't have been a hit in the 90s in the same way, you know? So I guess times are changing, and Image has been one that has evolved positively with the times, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, if you look at 20 years ago, it was all superhero stuff coming with an Image logo on it. But now, they still do superhero stuff, but necessarily straight. It's usually kind of parodies or more mature takes, and a lot of the stuff isn't spandex related at all. In fact, I don't think any of the stuff I'm talking about in this show is.
And they think about they think about possibilities for TV spin-offs, you know, with Walking Dead and so forth. They're very savvy, I should say. And I mean, for creators looking to go to Image is still one of, it's amazing that they're one of few even now independent publishers who accept unsolicited submissions from creative teams. So they won't hook you up with an artist or you know, a writer if you come as a, it's not like DC or Marvel where you come with a folio going, I want to draw Batman. You come to them, you pitch a project. If they're interested, they will get it published. So Image takes a fixed amount off the top of the profits. So the creator, you won't see a penny of profits until the cost of printing is covered. And then if the title fails, Image takes the brunt. You don't pay for anything. Okay. And if it's a success, you basically keep everything else. So it's, I guess it's a lucrative model for them. And Image obviously has to believe in the project. Otherwise, they wouldn't be interested in publishing anything that way. So it's actually quite an equitable system, I suppose. It's definitely a step above self-publishing, that's for sure.
True.
Yeah.
What's the first one you've got, my friend?
Yeah, I guess, I wouldn't mind opening up with Casanova.
Which I think now is done through Marvel, but back in the early days. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, it's now on Marvel's Icon imprint as of 2011. Yep. But from 2006, writer Matt Fraction and artist Gabriel Barr and Fabio Moon, one would fill in every now and then for the other, but it was predominantly by Gabriel Barr, I'm pretty sure. But this is such a fun series. It's about a thief, Casanova Quinn, and he's roped into becoming a double agent for a transdimensional spy organization called Empire, and with their arch nemesis, Newman Zeno, who is this face bandaged, super genius, hedonist lifestyle kind of guy. And the plots all involve time travel and parallel worlds and assassination jobs, some of which involve you taking down a target who's the ruler of a sex island, and another who's a magician who might be confused for the Messiah, which is why they're putting him down. And now it's into its third volume, as you mentioned, in Marvel. But I remember how exciting those Image issues were, especially those covers were so eye-catching. It's one of those comics that, and it stood out as well, it was a few kind of black and white comics on the shelf, now. And now it's in color because commerce dictates art.
Marvel loves color.
Yeah. But its original run was black, white, and kind of green, dark green for shading, and later was recolored quite sensitively, you know, with a limited palette. But it captures so many of the quirks of the kind of 1960s beat generation. It reminds me a lot of one of my favorite TV shows, The Prisoner. The original one, I should say. And it's easy to grab now in trade form. It's, if you like super spy stories, it's got a Jack Kirby-esque quality in terms of the crazy ideas getting thrown around and great kinetic wild action as well. I love this title a lot. Have you ever had a chance to dip in?
Yeah, it's pretty trippy. I've read the first couple issues, but I just couldn't get into it, to be honest. Perhaps, I mean, I've never read a whole arc or a whole collection.
It definitely reads better in the longer form. I mean, it's got a kind of Grant Morrison way of throwing crazy ideas around. I find it's a little bit less Grant Morrison-y. I don't know how to put that into words.
Yeah, with less Grant Morrison.
So what's your first selection?
Underground by Jeff Parker and Steve Lieber. You probably haven't heard of this one, Milan.
No,
it came out in 2010.
Not.
Okay, it's a 5-issue miniseries. It's written by Jeff Parker, as I said, who did Agents of Atlas, that I think I talked about last show, and he did the ongoing series X-Men First Class. And art is by Steve Lieber, who did the two Whiteout books. Basically, it's set in Stillwater Cave in Kentucky, which was closed in the 1960s, but now the town kind of wants to reopen it as they need the tourism. So basically, the first couple of pages, it opens with the two park rangers, Wesley, who's a girl. I didn't know Wesley could be a girl's name.
Unless now you do.
To think of Wesley Crusher. Ooh, burn. And Seth. They basically slept together for the first time, so it kind of opens up with their awkward kind of, do you think anyone at work will tell kind of thing? So it's pretty interesting. Wesley is pretty much the only person who really doesn't want the cave to be reopened because it's a bit dangerous, and, you know, she's quite into, you know, this cave has taken, you know, millions of years to form, and, you know, the human oil can disrupt it and all stuff, so we just leave it alone and leave nature alone. But some ex-criminals are kind of hired by, well, I won't say who, but to detonate parts of the cave. So when the inspector comes, he'll see that it's safe and accessible for the public. So these kind of detonations got opened up, mm-hmm. walkways and whatnot. Unfortunately, Seth, one of the rangers, gets trapped in there, and then Wesley has to go in there to rescue him. And there's like a kind of accidental gunshot. There's a chase between the criminals who detonate the place and the two park rangers. There's like bats, and there's like a explosion from the methane of the guano, and there's like, you know, there's fights where they're dangling on the ropes, and so it's quite intense. I mean, it's not, there's no supernatural elements, there's no kind of super heroics, it's just a kind of ordinary people in extraordinary situation kind of tale. Done in one, and the five issues, grab it in the trade. But the colouring is quite interesting, so the outside scenes in the daylight are all in colour, like you see the press and the mayor and all these people kind of gathering as this situation unfolds, and it's quite stressful, but it's more stressful inside, obviously, and that's all done as a two-tone, so because of the darkness of the cave. But it works really well. I haven't seen that before. And, I mean, there's been some pretty bad cave movies recently, but I think this would make a really good film. It's very believable. You can kind of tell that the writer Jeff Parker's done his research. The only good cave film I can think of was The Descent, where all the girls go in to the cave.
Yeah. Would what's that movie about the rock climber who gets his arm stuck? It's not really a cave movie, though, is it?
True, yes. 127 Hours.
That's a great movie.
But is it 27? Yeah.
100, yeah.
It is. So it's a rare book. It's got a female protagonist. It's got a good rhythm, kind of short scenes between the outside and the insides. And it's got the sort of set or the claustrophobia quite well. So it's quite an intense read. And I really enjoyed it. It's something that isn't wacky or doesn't have any outlandish concepts. It's I enjoyed it. So that's Underground by Jeff Parker and Steve Leeper.
That sounds good. The next title I've got is an anthology called Flight. Now, Image has put out quite a few anthologies over the past 10 years, I mean, to varying success, just like many anthology projects. I guess what makes Flight sort of stand out is kind of its approach is a little bit more friendly to, one, to new readers and to new creators as well. It's edited by Kazuki Bushi, and the first two volumes, I think, were 2004, 2005, and the 2005 volume was huge, a big, fat book, and they were put out by Image. Since then, it's been a twice-yearly publication, and I believe now it's no longer with Image.
Yes. It's funny to bring it up. Yes.
Yeah, and part of that is to do with the book has since Image's the Image days, it's benefited from wider bookstore distribution, and it's become by far the most successful anthology book of, you know, for the last 5 years of any publisher. And it's quite unusual because there's no unifying theme to any of the stories. Flight doesn't even always, you know, take part.
Yeah.
There's a really wide range of techniques, you know, in terms of artwork and storytelling, different tone, like from very adult serious ones to childish, you know, little quirky stories and different approaches. But it's definitely an all ages, it appeals to all ages of taste. And it's one book that I know has done very well in libraries and so forth. But it's a great example of the range capable in comics, you know, in one book to see such a huge variety. And I remember even at the time how nice it was to see one, a book just try all these different things. And it's notable that all of the illustrators are very young. I think they're all under 30.
Okay.
Yeah, except maybe a few are older, but young talent, and which is not surprising that that's a success, because outside of comic fandom, who really cares if a story in an anthology is written by Neil Gaiman or illustrated by Jim Lee? You know, no one knows who these people are outside of, you know, the comic fandom, I suppose. So, of course, you know, what difference does it make if it's a Korean artist who's very good at his work, or, you know, an established artist? So, you know, a successful book giving people, new talent a chance is always great in my book. I mean, similarly, Liquid City and 24/7 are both great image anthologies, yep. But none have matched, success that Flight has found. So, yeah.
Comic book tattoo, was that Image as well?
Yeah, that was Image as well, the Tori Amos-themed anthology. And I think that was a minor success. I don't know how well it... I think the price put a few people off.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been cheap to produce, I'd imagine, because it's quite a hefty tome. I've actually got your copy.
Yeah, I gave it away.
That's very nice of you. Give it away now.
It's heavy. It was making my shelf sag, seriously.
Yeah, it's not an easily transportable good. My second choice would be Chew, C-H-E-W. Now, this has been, this is kind of the first kind of sleeper hit. I rattled off a few other series that have seen a lot of kind of sellouts and second and third or fourth printings, but I guess Chew was kind of their first one. So this debuted a couple of years ago. It's written by John Layman with art by Rob Gilroy. I've mentioned it before, so I won't say too much about it, but the 25th issue has just been released. There's four trade paperbacks available now. Mm-hmm. The first two are even on the New York Times bestseller list, and there's a TV series in the works. Basically, it settles on this cop, Asian cop, Tony Chu, is in C-H-U. You know, he's a sipopath, which basically means he can eat something and then kind of get like a psychic impression of... There's a page in it. Why don't I just read the page? Tony Chu is sipopathic. That means he can take a bite of an apple and get a feeling in his head about what tree it grew from, what pesticides were used on the crop, and when it was harvested. Or he could eat a hamburger and flash onto something else entirely. The only food that doesn't affect him is beets. So he pretty much eats beets all the time, which means he's hungry a lot. So it's actually pretty interesting. So he and his partner in the first issue go undercover to an illegal chicken restaurant because in the new world, thanks to bird flu, chicken has now been made illegal. So there's like black market chicken gatherings where people can eat all the chicken they want. So it's kind of like the new drug on the streets. It's actually quite an interesting premise, and you can see it's a lot of black humour and wacky characters with strange names. So yeah, I can see a TV series kind of working. But yeah, he and his partner go undercover to this illegal chicken restaurant, and they set up the premise quite well. Tony is eating chicken soup, but while the chef is making it, he cuts his finger. So Tony drinks the soup,
ooh,
and it's got this guy's blood, and he senses that the chef is actually a serial killer. So he confronts him in the alley, but the chef goes, "You don't get to take me alone," and he kills himself. So Tony says, "Okay, I'm going to eat him." So he eats the guy to get the psychic impressions and to find out where all his victims are. So it's pretty interesting. But he gets found out, he gets fired from his job as a cop, and then offered a job in the very powerful Food and Drug Administration, which is kind of like the new CIA, FBI.
Cool.
And he's got this new partner, Mason Savoy, is this big kind of fancy-speaking big guy. But, yeah, it's actually pretty interesting. Mason Savoy is his partner, and there's only one other person who's also a sipopath, is this mad Serbian guy. But it's actually quite a wacky concept, very accessible, very readable, and I hope they do a TV series out of it. The art is quite manga, quite funny. I guess if you're not sold on wacky ideas like that, you might think it's a bit too far-fetched or whatever, but it's not meant to be realistic. But it's quite funny and accessible. So, yeah, that's Chew, Volume 1. Taster's Choice.
Nice. I wonder if the TV show, just thinking of our race relations show last week.
Thinking the same thing.
Yeah, whether they'll hire the guy who plays Jin in Lost, which seems to be their go-to Asian actor for TV shows these days, or whether it'll be the white guy who's in Moonlighting and Hawaii 5-0. Not moonlighting. Moonlight, I should say. He's a vampire detective by night.
Oh, the Aussie guy, yes.
Yes. And
Alex Lachlan?
I sort of suspect he'll be a white guy called Chu. You know how, like, they're recasting Akira with white people with names like Canada? Yeah, it's embarrassing when you say it like that. But I hope I hope they keep it an Asian-American lead. That would be great. Yeah. Another fun title from Image is Orkstein. Have you?
Yes.
Yeah, this is a great one. It's words, 100% by James Stoker, I should say, because words and art and editor, he's his own editor and everything. And I guess this is a great thing about Image. They do get to have 100% control over their project, which is rare and satisfying. So they succeed or fail on their own terms. But he previously did a project with Oni Press, but I think Auxane was the first time I ever noticed James Stokoe. And now it's up to issue 7. And this is a very unusual fantasy story. It's told from the perspective of orcs, who are usually the punching bags of fantasy stories. And here they're not turned into sympathetic characters. This isn't an attempt to go, everything you've heard about orcs is wrong. It's more, they are horrible, violent, nasty animals, but their world is so bizarre that... And you're treated to like this view of what it's like to live in this terrifying reality that you do sort of see where they're coming from. It follows a character called One Eye. He's an orc, I should say. And he has this uncanny knack for safe breaking. And when I say safes, I mean like buried totems of dead orc kings. So basically stealing their buried gold. And he has a knack for sort of getting past the magical talismans and so forth, guarding the tombs. And he's pursued by these massive armies who need his special skills for their political reasons, and then he gets involved with orc characters along the way. It's an outcast story with a very keen sense of character and a really wild imagination, especially for fantasy. I mean, when you compare it to what the hit fantasy story is at the moment, which is Game of Thrones, and that's a series I consider to be something that plays very safe, if you follow, as in it calls back to
Lord of all the tropes that you expect.
Yes, exactly. Whereas Auxane just wants to try things slightly differently, I suppose, and because the ideas are presented not in that straightforward way. He doesn't tell you everything. He gives you a few clues, and there's that joy in after following a long, confusing sequence. And then at the end, it's almost like the final piece of the puzzle falls into place, and then as the reader, you kind of get what was the deal with everything that just happened. And that I kind of find that sort of storytelling sort of satisfying and fascinating. But he's definitely a creator, and the book, it's a creator with a very distinct aesthetic. If anyone's seen it, reds and greens and purples really dominate. It's funny, action-packed, very clearly told, the palette, as I mentioned. And because it's wild, you think it's in, you know, crazy wild colouring, but it's very restrained. It's like a crazy fever dream, but with rules. You know, you won't see colours that don't belong. But this is just an easy and fun comic to get sucked into, and the world is fascinating. Definitely a comic that stands out, for sure. Auxane.
And he's doing Godzilla.
Yeah, that's right. That's such a perfect fit, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I've never seen a Godzilla comic that I've liked, to be honest. And then when I saw his illustration of Gojira screaming, and he's done even the scream in his inimitable cartooning style, it suddenly made sense, like, this could be a crazy wild monster story. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Mm. So, yeah, that's coming out from IDW, I think, in August or something. Mm. But, yeah, he's kind of detailed Jeff Darrow-esque. Kind of art is a perfect fit. Girls by the Luna Brothers. Have you heard of this one?
Talking about girls.
Well, I don't know much. they're like us, but with longer hair. So I've got there's been six trade paperbacks. No, there hasn't. There's been four, sorry. But the one I've got collects the first six issues.
Gotcha.
It's by Joshua Luna. Written by Joshua Luna, and his brother, Jonathan Luna, does the artwork. And I've actually just started reading also from Image Comics, Whisper, which is art and writing by Joshua Luna. And I've read the first two issues, and it's pretty awesome. It's like this guy who kind of dreams and then walks around and visits other people while he's sleeping. But anyway, that's an awesome series. But yes, Girls is kind of, it's pretty odd. I think, again, a film has been in the works for a while. Might be noticing a theme here. This was first published in 2007. The first trade paperback, fittingly enough, is titled Conception, and it's got a naked girl on the cover, so with her hair flowing everywhere. So, you know, what's not to like about that? So it's pretty fitting because the first few pages basically follow sperm. Yes, you heard me. But the whole story centers on this kind of guy called Ethan Daniels, who works at the only store in this tiny kind of hick town to some degree called Pennystown in America. One night he gets drunk and shouts his mouth off at all the women in the bar at the town, and the sheriff throws him out. On his way home, he's driving and he sees a naked girl kind of stumble on the road, but she's not really speaking or saying much. He takes her home. And she basically just repeats what he's saying. So he's like, he has no idea. You know, he just picked up this random naked lady and he's trying to be a gallant gentleman. They, have sex. And in the next morning, she basically vomits and he opens the bathroom door and there's all these eggs, like kind of human-sized eggs, and then naked girls, which look just like her, hatch from them and attack all the women in the town. The people try to leave, but there's a big sperm monster. Yeah, you heard me. So it's kind of got an interesting intersection of small town dynamics mm-hmm. with not a lot of interest, not a lot of nice characters, really. Everybody's kind of foul mouthed. There's a lot of swearing in here. There's a fair bit of nudity. It is an adult tale. The art is quite simple and cartoony, but there's a lot of kind of Photoshopery, out of focus backgrounds and foregrounds to make it look a bit more cinematic, I guess. It's kind of, it is quite interesting. It's by the Luna Brothers, called Girls. If you're into a more serious kind of intersection of big fantasy sci-fi ideas with the kind of mundane reality, it's quite an interesting tale to pick up if you're into adult stuff, not for the kids.
I'm so glad you brought that one up, because that's one I've kept meaning to read, and that's been a nice reminder just then, that little blurb from you to grab it again.
Yeah, it's interesting. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, I guess it's different from a lot of the other stuff that we've talked about, because it is more of the adult scale. Mm-hmm. But it's rare that you'll find a good balance between the kind of unusual fantastical elements and the kind of mundane reality small town people elements. But it actually does it quite well.
Sounds like a great mystery to pull you along as well.
Yes, well, I've only read the first volume, so I have no idea what's coming next, but yeah, it's hard not to be intrigued by its setup so far.
Secrets revealed in future volumes, I assume. Let's go in the complete opposite end of from adult material to something which is quite pulpy, and this is from the 90s. 96 to 99. Can you guess?
Okay.
Yeah.
Will be 96 to 99. Ninja Turtles.
Yes. You're very impressive, I've got to say.
Well, I was just trying to think what was around that era and what's... Ninja Turtles isn't pop. Is it pulpy? The approach was kind of pulpy.
This approach is very, this approach is very pulpy. This particular run, which makes up the third volume of the Ninja Turtles series and has now been called out of continuity, bit of a shame. But it's quite controversial, I remember this run. And I know even since its run, Eastman and Laird weren't fully in support of it. But I personally really love it. it definitely is a little bit different to the older Ninja Turtle comics you might be aware of, and forget about it if you've only seen the cartoon series or the Archie.
Was it a half shell?
Turtle Power. Eric Larson was the book runner on this, Savage Dragon writer for Image. And as the book runner, I believe he passed on the actual script writing to Gary Carlson, and it's penciled by Frank Fosco. And this all happened after Mirage Studios ceased publishing comics in 1995. So Image put out 23 monthly issues, black and white artwork, which is nice. But they made a few changes, which I know fans weren't a fan of. And on the surface, they appear a little bit gimmicky. Leonardo...
April O'Neil's now blonde.
Is that it?
No, I don't know. That was a guess.
She has blue hair and she's in a wheelchair. No, that's not true. That's the Ghostbusters Extreme spin-off TV series that was short-lived. Yes. Do you remember that one?
It was like cartoon.
Yes, I do. Yeah. So Leonardo loses a hand. Raphael's face is horrifically scarred. Donatello is seriously injured and like paralyzed, so he becomes a cyborg.
Wow.
And among other things, Raphael ends up taking leadership of the foot in order to take down the mob, but then he stays in charge, kind of posing as Shredder. There's always a... And I know people don't like when people change things they recognize, but I personally was like, you know, these four brothers who are kind of identical looking, to have a change in their status quo like that, which... Yeah. you know, even since their earliest days, they're so kind of similar. And it's good to see them just not retreading that same ground. So physical change means you can also kind of extend their inner lives outwards. So Raphael's always been the lonely brooder, so now his face is scarred. Leonardo's always had a chip on his shoulder about being the leader, and now he's, you know, got one hand tied behind his back, you know, that kind of thing, I suppose. And Donatello, obviously, he does machines.
As the theme song reminds us.
But it means they could carve out their own identities, I guess. It's not a perfect series. I mean, a lot of the storylines involved the mob, which was kind of great to not see them fighting ninjas. Like, how do these four mutant turtles deal with...
Who's the mob? Is that, like, the hand?
No, as in, like, mafia.
Oh, right, okay.
That kind of mob. So to see them take down quite mundane criminals, it works, because you remember the old Ninja Turtle comics... I guess it's just the first issue, more so. It was a tribute to Daredevil at that point. So it all kind of works together. It's got less of the aliens and so forth. I think there's alien species in this as well. But it's one of few instances, I think, where Image has taken on a licensed property from outside their own.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, so it kind of stands out in that regard as well. But because it's no longer popular, it's one that might be hard to track down. But if you're at all interested in the history of Ninja Turtles, especially with the new film to be coming out, this one is definitely a different approach. You know, a really fun read, and just nice to see these characters doing something different other than the same old crap. You
know? I can understand why those changes were controversial, because they're pretty big.
Well, what do you think about that? If you just heard that, do you reckon that sounds gimmicky, or?
I mean, that would be my take, because I mean that's what superhero publishers Marvel and DC are infamous for.
We're changing everything.
Our superhero seriously? Yeah, we're going to cut his head off. We're going to, you know, dismember them. Now we're not a kids show anymore. How's the stance on the digestion of pizzas? Where do they stand on that?
Was that something, I'm trying to remember, was that even in the comics or was that in the TV show?
No, that's got to be a TV series.
That's got to be some dumb crap from the TV series. Yeah, but that's stuck
and
around.
They didn't wear different coloured bandanas in the original comic either, I'd imagine.
Well, that kind of does the opposite of what a mask is supposed to do, because if a mask is supposed to conceal your identity, that makes your identity even more obvious.
Go for the blue one.
He's the leader. You just know it, you see?
Ninja Turtles comics are currently being published by IDW, I believe.
A comic with a long pedigree and many adaptations of varying quality.
Yeah, they've had a lot of publishers, haven't they, over the last few years?
Yeah, but the current ones are good. I've only had a chance to quickly read a couple out of order, but I've really quite enjoyed them. So
I've read the first couple of issues, and I think isn't Eastman kind of overseeing it or co-plotting it or something?
Yeah, so, you know, taking on, I guess, more of a hands-on approach to his creations again.
Baby.
I wonder if he has a love-hate relationship with these characters by now.
Yeah, I guess it's you become... Well, they're not really known for anything else, are they?
No.
But that's cool. I'd be happy with just being a millionaire known for Ninja Turtles. I'm down with that. Sticking with the animal theme, Ratfist. Now, Doug Tenable, he created Earthworm Jim, which I never grew up with, but I believe you did in playing this video game,
yeah,
and those cartoon series and whatnot. So this is his first webcomic. He's been producing his OGNs, so original graphic novels, which I believe the majority of them have been published through Image Comics. So at least once a year he'll do a new, and there's some really awesome. Earthboy Jacobus was a great one. He's got wonderful black and white kind of thick brush strokey work. It's just fantastic, and he's got such big ideas that he doesn't really do monthly issues, so if you see a hardcover with Doug Tenable on it, grab it, and you'll be pretty much all ages friendly. Something usually with kind of family theme and, you know, some good themes with a bit of a nice message, feel good message at the end of it. But yeah, this is kind of very wacky. His first webcomic, and he talks about starting the webcomic and how inspired he was by Axcop in the last few pages. And if you do read Axcop, which is the series published by Dark Horse Comics in print, this is, I think you'll love this as I did. It's wacky, it's far out, man, and it doesn't really seem like a webcomic. You know what I mean? Like when they translate web comics, it's not necessarily stop and start or whatever. It flows very well. There's a nice mix of kind of, full splash pages and panel arrangements. It's in colour. He talks about the colouring in the book as well. But basically, there's this guy, Ricky. He proposes to his girlfriend, Gina, but he must give up his life. His life as a crime fighter, and his crime fighting life is basically Rat Fist. That's his name. He's basically a guy in a one piece kind of unitard with two kind of floating black ears. He's just a normal guy. So he does one last job, and he's got this talking. Well, this guy, this rat, Milt. He gets attacked by this kind of weird rat in his employer's workplace, and then this dog man hybrid security guard basically attacks him. It's all very weird. And as he proposes to his girlfriend, he starts to realize that the rat that attacked him kind of merged into him, and he starts to grow a tail and become more rat-like. So he gets annoyed by this tail because it starts speaking. All of Ricky's subconscious thoughts, everyone around him can hear what he's thinking. So he chops his tail off and then wraps it around him as part of his costume. So he's kind of got this talking rat tail kind of ally. It's pretty interesting. Like his boss, he starts working for a boss of like this secret organization who's like a tutu wearing czar. Earth and Jim shows up in a cameo, which is nice. The main bad guy is a cat. There's this creature called Monkey Trout, which is a hybrid of a monkey and a trout, very freaky looking. There's like an alternate future. There's a cure for cancer. There's the last dodo bird. Oh, very odd. You know, stormtrooper looking bad guys show up. It's very zany and wacky. And as I said, if you liked Axe Cop, you'll like this. And much like Axe Cop, I found myself lolling, laughing out loud. Like, just it's very hard sometimes to do humor well in comics, but he's a master, Dr. Nabel. So, and there's a great mix of kind of poignancy and good kind of drama with kind of superhero heroic parody and just shenanigans. It is a very, just a funny book, and it's something you can hand to anybody and just be really accessible. Just his facial expressions and his dialogue and just his timing is superb, Maladam. So that's called Rat Fist, full colour, Dr. Nabel, just came out, I think, last month. So grab it if you see it. That's, I guess, probably a very recent one from Image Comics. And I don't know if they publish webcomics a lot, but, yeah, I loved it.
Excellent. My final choice is also probably my favourite Image book probably ever. So that's
okay.
That's a huge endorsement from me. But it's a 6-issue mini called The Nightly News.
Ah, of course.
Now this is great. This is also the book that introduced me to John, and I think everyone, to Jonathan Hickman. I don't think he'd done any comics before this. This was back in 2006, and I remember remember noticing these issues out of everything else on the shelf, because it's not hard to be struck by these covers are designed. I mean, everything about these comics has a sense of design in them, and for covers with a restrained palette, you know. Just a single image with kind of just abstract sort of Adobe Illustrator shapes on there. It really stands out, and it doesn't disappoint when you actually, you know, from those opening pages, and there's a shock execution. The plot and the book kind of grabs you and just doesn't, I know it's a cliche, doesn't let go. Yeah. But it addresses kind of the problems of the corrupt news media, which is all chasing ratings and monetary gain. The facts suffer, and the story is about a cult run by an elusive character called The Hand, and he's seeking to kind of right all the wrongs of the sort of callous news managers who are ruining people's lives, basically, by, you know, reporting wrong facts, you know, about murders and so forth. So that's hence the shock assassination. To balance this out, the book's told with all these infographics and charts and pictures with actual statistics from the real world. He's got an agenda to push, but it's done so in an engaging way, and it's a really ripping yarn as a story as well. So this is a great fun one, and it's so refreshing to read something that makes you go, this is not like any other comic I've read. It's
yes.
It was very modern.
It does push the boundaries in that sense, doesn't it? And that's what a lot of people notice. Like, it's very, just the way it tells a story, it kind of reminds you that there's so much potential within the comic storytelling medium. And yeah, he hasn't done a lot because obviously his artwork, and I guess it takes a lot of time. So Hickman's mainly been writing lately. Yes. He's done a few more Image comic series, Red Wing and whatnot, and he's been writing lately for Marvel, Fantastic Four, and a few other things. But yes, fantastic, and a book that is very a good gateway book, I think, as well.
This is one I've like enthusiastically handed out to dozens of friends.
Yeah, we've both recommended it quite a lot to people, haven't we?
So who don't read comics, and they've all loved it because it stood out. And then when they asked, "Well, what else is like this?" I'm like, "Well, not a lot." So
no, that's true.
And I love that Image Comics, you know, takes a chance with a book from. I think it was really, this was, you know, his first time writing, illustrating a comic, and they saw the potential in this great story idea with a really novel way of presenting it. And I guess that's what's special about Image Comics as well. But this is, The Nightly News by Jonathan Hickman.
And quite a risky choice as well. Like, it's not exactly a mainstream, you know, I mean, you don't see the Nightly News presented to you thinking, this is going to fly. I mean, it did, but, you know, when you're presented with it, it doesn't necessarily stream mainstream appeal, but thankfully it did just that. The last one I wanted to mention is Term Life. This is published by the Shadowline imprint, which is Jim Valentino, who's one of the founders of Image, his imprint. So published by Shadowline and Image. It's written by AJ Lieberman, who I think did Cowboy Ninja Viking, another Image series, with art by Nick Thornborough. It's, again, a realistic tale, very pulpy, noirish. It doesn't have any Ninja Turtles or pizza in it, but it's... Actually, no, I think it does have Peter. But so it basically focuses on this guy, Nick Barrow, and his job is he helps out like bank robbers and criminals. He sets up the heist, so he gives them all the details but doesn't take part in it. So he'll say, okay, the security guard is leaving at this time. This is when the shift changes. So he'll sell jobs to crims, and then it's up to the crims to kind of – does that make sense?
Yeah, like Moriarty in the new Sherlock series.
Really?
Yeah, he's a consulting criminal.
Okay, I haven't got to watching those, but I think you can tell me too.
Yeah.
So he sells his latest job to this guy, Yuri. Yuri dies off-panel, so his Russian gangster dad, Victor, goes after Nick, but Nick basically knows nothing. He just sold him a job, but he doesn't know who killed Yuri or why. So Nick is in a whole lot of trouble. So Nick has this 13-year-old daughter, but her mum doesn't want her to see Nick, as Nick basically said to her, look, I'll go straight years ago when you didn't come through with that promise. So what Nick does is he takes out $1 million life insurance policy on himself with his daughter Kate as the sole beneficiary, but the problem is that it takes 21 days to be activated. So he has to stay alive for the 21 days and avoid Yuri's dad, Victor, who he's mistakenly pinned this murder of his son on Nick. So he's got to stay alive, avoid these gangsters for his plan, to make his plan work, and kind of, you know. So it's pretty interesting. It's got a great kind of crime noir twist, and the way the story is told is through a lot of overlapping scenes and lines of dialogue, which can be annoying at times, but it's done very well. That's not repetitive. Mature dialogue, a fair bit of violence, but mainly the language, and a great premise. And there's like scenes with, you know, corrupt cops and lawyers, but it's effectively it's Nick's story, and it's interesting to see him kind of save his daughter and reconnect with his kind of morose, estranged daughter, and their relationship that grows throughout all this kind of turmoil. It's very kind of hard boiled. Like, Nick's always getting shot at and beaten up. He has bandages on his face all the time, like Marvin Sin City, which is a Dark Horse comic, not an Image, but nonetheless. It's very multi-layered. The art is quite sketchy and simple, but so it's not realistic, but it does actually surprisingly work quite well. Like, there's a lot of kind of loose lines and not clearly defined in the artwork, if you know what I mean. The colour palette is quite restrained. It's simple. It's not overly detailed at all, but it does work a treat. So this kind of flew under the radar. When it first came out, I noticed it didn't really get a lot of press and whatnot, but it does deserve it. So that's called Term Life, and it's an OGN, so it's really just a graphic novel, so it's just a done-in-one tale, and I really enjoyed it. I did want to mention a couple of other quick others, but like you said at the start, we talked about Huey's Jake Ellis, which I recommend, Elephant Man, which is pretty awesome. Savage Dragon, I read the first early issues, and that's a pretty good superhero title. And I'm about to read King City, by Brandon Graham to review that for Broken Frontier, but I have yet to read that, but I've heard wonderful things about it.
I've been looking forward to that one a lot. It's also worth mentioning Non-Player, which was a huge hit 2 years ago now. Wow. Viking is a great one as well. 1963 is a fun one from the early Image Comics, and I do enjoy dipping into the old Spawn comics here and there. And if you want to talk to Eric Larson, I do believe he is still active on the Image boards. So, yeah, if you want to ask him about Image Comics or nag him with your stupid pitch ideas, they have a forum for that, for people who aren't quite ready but just want to go, would you like it if I made a pitch for this idea about a vampire who actually is a undersea marine biologist, and then he usually says no.
Oh, what an undersea marine biologist you say.
These are the ideas I think of when it's past midnight and I'm recording a podcast and my eyes are closing as it was recorded.
All our listeners and myself and Image Comics appreciate your bleary-eyed dedication. Well, that's our show. If you did have anything that you think we have missed some, I'm sure we can't talk about all of them because, you know, once you get to our age, and particularly mine, our memory is sketchy. But those are the ones that stood out in the last few years in our reading habits. But mention some of your Image Comics faves on the Facebook or email us, Chris with a K at extrasequential.com. Or all future shows are also on iTunes, as we continue to say. And thanks to, Broken Frontier, we're going to put up a whole bunch of Image stuff, so keep your eyes and monitors and various computer devices pointed to brokenfrontier.com for more Image goodness.
And, of course, hello to everyone.
This has been a pretty good trip down memory lane.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, hello to everyone who's joining us from Broken Frontier, maybe for the first time. How you going? What's up?
We can hear you.
You know, I was just thinking the undersea, you know, marine biologist vampire idea makes sense because it's really dark down there.
No daylight, yeah.
Yeah, it's like 30 days of night. Is that what it's called?
True, but where would they get the blood?
Whales.
Deep sea divers, they don't go down very often.
They're Japanese fishermen vampires who
eat they whales and dolphins.
Yeah, there you go.
This thing writes itself. I think there's an Aquaman cameo. It's all good.
Copyright 2012, everyone. You heard it here first.
Thanks for listening. If we said all of our sign off stuff that we need to say.
Music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. You can catch Chris's writing at Comic Book Jesus and mine at The Find Mag.
And you hear your songs on Triple J Unearthed, I hear.
On Triple J proper, thank you. Yeah,
nice one.
I got played on the
Australian radio show.
The best one, as far as I
Congratulations, your musical career is going gangbusters. Well done.
Yeah, that's the image I like to portray anyway.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We don't know what we're going to be talking about next week, but we'll let you know.
Yes, thanks, everyone. Let us know your favourites. I want to hear what everyone's favourite Image comics are, actually.
Yeah,
so I can ridicule you. Anyway, see ya.
Bye now. This feeling you've left me is the image of me.